Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello. On this week's program, Susan Lewis explores the Philadelphia Museum of Art's latest exhibition, Picasso and the Avant-Garde in Paris. Cameron Carpenter fancies himself as the avenging angel of the organ world. He dresses in white with rhinestones. He plays with phenomenal technique, and he wants to change everything. David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to his upcoming concert at the Kimmel Center. In the latest installment in our Wicked Philadelphia series, Tom Keels looks at how the city of brotherly love was a hotbed for the world's oldest profession during the 18th and 19th centuries, and we speak with Nellie Berman. The veteran music educator is launching a new type of classical music competition aimed at teens and preteens. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In a life that spanned more than 90 years, the Spanish master Pablo Picasso created thousands of paintings, sculptures, ceramics, drawings, and prints. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, drawing mostly from its own collection, focuses on the work of Picasso and his contemporaries during the first half of the 20th century, when Cubism and Surrealism evolved and modern art came into its own. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Picasso and the Avant-Garde in Paris.
The first work in the show is an iconic self-portrait. A young man in a loose white shirt looks out from the canvas past us, a palette in his left hand, his right hand empty, even though in every study leading up to the final painting, he'd been holding a paintbrush.
I think he figured once he got to that part of the painting, why do I need it?
Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of modern art, Michael Taylor, suggests the work foreshadows Picasso's intent to challenge artistic conventions.
Painting up until this point had been too traditional, too rule-bound. The ideas of perspective, all the things he was getting rid of. He always looks like a boxer to me in this painting. He's going to take on the art world by storm.
A storm which gets underway rather quickly, as reflected in this chronologically laid-out show. Museum education curator Marla Shoemaker says while Picasso's self-portrait shows an image intact,
you move into the next gallery and suddenly everything looks like shattered glass. He and Georges Braque, with whom he shared a studio, begin playing off each other's work and taking forms apart and putting them back together in entirely different ways and unexpected ways.
Although Picasso is the headliner of this exhibition with 56 works, Michael Taylor has included 157 pieces by 60 other artists as well.
If you want to understand Cubism, you need to have figures like Georges Braque and Juan Gris. If you want to understand Picasso's relationship with Surrealism, you need Max Ernst and Salvador Dali and Juan Miró. So I think that this goes beyond a traditional monographic show on Picasso and gives you a closer look at what happened in Paris in the first half of the 20th century.
Paris had cabarets, cafes, and dance halls, but it was not the bustling metropolis it is today, says University of Pennsylvania art history professor Christine Poggi, author of In Defiance of Painting, Cubism, Futurism, and the Invention of Collage.
People could live there very, very cheaply. They could get credit in the local cafes, and they could meet each other. They could talk, show each other their work, be in and out of each other's studios in an environment that was not yet the Paris of today. I think it was more of a village.
A village that took art seriously, home to artists, collectors, and venues to show work, all of which would have appealed to Picasso. Born and raised in Spain, he studied with his father and at art academies. He won honorable mention at an international art show in Paris when he was only 19. Not long afterwards, the young artist moved there.
He seems to have wanted to be in the liveliest, most dynamic place he could. He's a very ambitious artist. And he probably knows that this will make his own art more interesting and that he'll be able to challenge himself even more and have a public that can, to some extent, then interact with his art because he will be breaking conventions and testing new things, and that's more likely to be well received.
Picasso and Braque painted their surroundings in the cafes, experimenting with different ways of representing what was right in front of them, bottles of wine, newspapers, guitars, and decks of cards. Michael Taylor says instead of trying to replicate the visual experience with traditional use of perspective and shading,
they leave the surface of the painting flat. And what they replace perspective with were these floating transparent planes. And I think all of the great Cubist paintings are like decks of cards where they're sort of shuffling reality in front of our eyes. It's really a way of reordering reality.
These Cubist still lifes show objects from different angles that couldn't possibly be seen all at once. But education curator Marla Shoemaker says if you look closely, you can get the sense of the artistic process. Because they depict common, recognizable objects.
Like a newspaper looks like a newspaper always. Then they can really manipulate the forms.
As an example, she points to an image of the Paris newspaper, where the letters of the word journal are broken up to make a visual pun.
The first part of that word journal is the word jeu, which means game. So sometimes the artist will carefully cover up the last half of that, so the word J-O-U. And it reminds you that they are playing a game sometimes just with themselves of how can I make this shape come forward and this shape go back? How can I split this shape in half and turn one side over?
Cubism led to collage, as Picasso began to test all the norms of painting. Penn's Christine Poggi says the artist's interest in African masks and other art further liberated him to reorder features, incorporate non-traditional materials such as bits of oilcloth, newspaper, and playing cards, and mix genres.
Some of the early collages he made and constructions investigate the relationship of sculpture and painting. Some of the three-dimensional collages have bits of painting on them, or strings will mimic perspective. So there's a back and forth between painting and sculpture.
Cubism and collage sparked responses from various artists from America and Europe. A wall of photographs includes shots of Picasso, Braque, Man Ray, and Gertrude Stein, the writer who was also a patron, hosting dinner parties and collecting works by Picasso, Matisse, and others. In the center of the exhibition is a large gallery, its deep red-colored walls adorned by works like Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase and Jean Métinger's Tea Time, or Woman with a Teaspoon, dubbed by a critic the Mona Lisa of Cubism. In the center, to sit on, is a circular upholstered pouf created for the show by Philadelphia artist Virgil Marty. The gallery itself, says Michael Taylor, conjures the idea of the 1912 salon which introduced the public to Cubism. But it was Cubism without Picasso or Braque. Why? Their dealer believed that showing at the salon would invite ridicule.
They were accompanied by a lot of press coverage. The press would make caricatures and jokes. And you can imagine the fun that these cartoonists had with women made of cubes and things like that. And that's exactly what Carnweiler, Picasso, and Braque's dealer wanted to avoid.
Yet for the artists who did participate,
what's fascinating is you do have this sense in which, for the cubists, this was an exciting moment. They published a book which tries to explain to the public what cubism is. But it was all for nothing. The press still made fun of them.
The show continues to Cubism between the wars, when Picasso painted his three musicians and Ferdinand Léger created the city. It includes a period when Taylor says many pleaded for a return to order and more conventional artwork. Later galleries explore Picasso and Surrealism, including Dali, Eastern Europeans drawn to Paris, such as Brancusi, and art created during the Second World War, including works by Marc Chagall and Jacques Lipschitz. Here stands Picasso's large sculpture, Man with a Lamb. The show, says Michael Taylor, highlights Picasso's variety and a powerful period in art.
Those 4 decades are so crucial, I think, because it takes you from the self-portrait to the Man with a Lamb, and everything in between is really a challenge to tradition, a challenge to perspective and illusionism.
Picasso lived a personal life as adventurous as his art, fathering 4 children by 3 different women. As an artist, though he's been claimed as a model by many, Picasso never advocated one movement or another. Over his lifetime, he created thousands of paintings, sculptures, collages, ceramics, drawings, and prints, inspiring his contemporaries and those who would come after to be bold, inventive, and push against the boundaries in the name of art.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Picasso and the Avant-Garde in Paris is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through April 25th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Cameron Carpenter is known as the bad boy of the organ world. At age 28, he improvises extravagantly on popular tunes while also playing the standards of Bach. He dresses all in white so as to resemble an avenging angel and is ready to leave the pipe organ completely behind for a digital organ, thus freeing him from the larger site-specific instruments to tour wherever he is wanted, and maybe even in places that wouldn't think to want him, such as the Grand Canyon. Cameron Carpenter plays a recital a week from today at the Kimmel Center. There's no telling what he'll do, since he doesn't announce programs in advance. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns visited him in his Lower East Side New York apartment recently.
Intense, bizarre, flamboyant, outrageous, and deadly serious. All those words apply to Cameron Carpenter when you meet him in the laboratory where he is formulating what could be an unprecedented career. His compact one-room apartment has no resemblance to an organ loft. It's Spartan, in a way, but eventful, containing two keyboard instruments, both digital, that he plays with noise-canceling headphones, typewriters, he collects them because he loves typefaces, lots of books on all subjects, and a cat named Kitty Ball. His personality, it's safe to say, is far bigger than his apartment. Cameron Carpenter was still a teenager when he transcribed Mahler's Symphony No. 5 for organ. In Wilmington, Delaware, he played the second half of a concert in drag. More often, he likes to sparkle, with crystals applied to his white concert garb. Yet before you can say the word Liberace, even his detractors admit that he plays organ better than most anybody. More than that, he's upending everything you thought you knew about the organ. In effect, he's saying, think again, think differently, and don't forget to buy my CD.
Self-promotion is regarded as this, you know, this evil thing, but self-promotion, I would posit, is a complete reality for every artist who wants their work to be taken remotely seriously. Because for me, self-promotion is the ultimate endorsement that my work is good, because I am able to feel confident saying to others, you should spend your money on this.
Would you do a centerfold or something like that?
Unquestionably. There's no discussion. Yeah, instantly.
Behind that showmanship, though, is a musician who plays not because he wants to, not because it's a nice thing to do, and not because it's a platform for fame, as if organists ever really become famous. Cameron Carpenter plays because he has to.
I can't keep away. It's like I'm some kind of addict. I have to do it. I have no choice. It's like the outflow of energy from my body that's able to be tactile through not just hands but also feet, and then the rest of the body is sort of connecting the whole thing.
However mystical he can be, Cameron Carpenter makes other organists a bit nervous. It's that loose cannon quality that also belies a certain lack of good taste. He also makes other organists envious with his ability to manipulate several keyboards and pedals at the same time. John Binsfeld, the now retired but longtime organist at Old Christ Church in Philadelphia, saw Carpenter on YouTube and says it's one of the most impressive organ techniques he's ever seen.
Anybody who has that kind of talent coupled with the kind of draw that he obviously has, I mean, he's become a name nationally known very quickly. What is the old adage? There is no such thing as bad publicity. So for organ, which has always suffered, with just exceptions plopping up every once in a while as extraordinary players, the name draws more than the instrument, because you associate the instrument with religious occasions. It's on the left-hand side of the main street.
Even as a Carpenter admirer, Binsfeld fears that all the exterior trappings will become an end in themselves, as they did with Carpenter's closest antecedent, Virgil Fox, a deeply respected organist who toured rock venues in the 1970s with his own organ, wearing capes and rhinestones. One major difference with Carpenter is technology. He's developing a digital organ scheduled to be done by the end of the summer, using sounds sampled from pipe organs, but with none of the faultiness of their antique technology. His instrument will always be in tune and will be portable. Unlike most organists, he'll be able to perform on the instrument he owns, as opposed to constantly adapting to somebody else's. It's likely to change his life and allow him to tour places nobody ever dreamed of hearing music, much less an organ.
I would very much like to play this instrument outside in the Sonic Caverns in the Grand Canyon. and on an aircraft carrier, among a few, many, many other things. Bach at Big Sur, for instance. And there's something that the pipe organ is totally incapable of, and that's the spontaneous musical happening.
Like most people, Cameron Carpenter is maybe best explained by his roots. His initially seem unlikely in blue-collar Meadville in western Pennsylvania north of Pittsburgh. His mom opted for homeschooling. She sensed he was a bit different. And when a Hammond organ arrived in the household, his isolation bred originality and partly accounts for his predilection for electronic instruments.
God, it was so great. And I just used to play that thing for hundreds of hours a week. I just loved it, until my brother accidentally backed a forklift truck into it and destroyed it.
If you stand back from Cameron Carpenter, his need for mobility, his eccentricities, his command of the instrument and ability to improvise, one sees perhaps not so much a 21st century organist, but something that reaches a bit further back to the world of 19th century virtuosos. That prototype, from Franz Liszt to Vladimir de Pachman, fits him to a T, and that's fine. We haven't had one of those in quite a while.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Cameron Carpenter in tomorrow's paper. Cameron performs a recital on the Fred J. Cooper pipe organ at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Saturday next at 3. Last month, four men were arrested and charged with running a South Philadelphia prostitution ring that netted nearly $10,000 a week. This is only the latest chapter in the long history of the so-called sporting life in the city. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores how the oldest profession is one of Philadelphia's oldest professions.
In August 1800, a group of concerned citizens in the Southwark District, along the Delaware River below South Street, decided to improve their neighborhood by torching a large chunk of it. An angry mob burned down the China Factory, a notorious brothel located on what is now Alter Street, between Front and Second. Clarissa Dillon is a scholar of 18th century Philadelphia.
Two customers got into an altercation, and eventually one of the combatants was knocked down and didn't get up. He was carried into an adjoining building where he died. And the law was called, and they arrested the survivor, and that seemed to be the end of things. But the next day, the neighbors came out and not only burned down the brothel, but the buildings surrounding it, as an indication of their disapproval of this whole thing.
The destruction of the China Factory marked a sea change in the practice of the oldest profession in Philadelphia. Prostitution, if not condoned, had been an accepted feature of life in the 18th century city. This was especially true after the Revolution, when, according to Dillon, departing British soldiers left behind an army of discarded concubines.
There really was nothing left for these young women, and because Philadelphia was a port and had sailors from all over the world whipping in and out, there were opportunities there. They weren't pleasant, but they were there.
After the Revolution, Philadelphia became the largest and richest city in America, serving as the national capital from 1790 to 1800. It also became the national party town, described by social historian Richard Godbeer as boisterous in body and remarkable for its lack of restraint. Dillon suggests that even some of our founding fathers may have taken advantage of the absence of the founding mothers.
I'm sure the politicians did the sorts of things they do now. It's just that you are careful of what you write down and what you leave for people to read.
In the 19th century, a wave of moral zeal pushed prostitutes out of Center City. In response, they followed the growing city north to the new industrial districts filled with single male workers. A vice zone called the Tenderloin emerged near Franklin Square. John Alvidi, senior curator of collections at the Franklin Institute Science Museum, defines the Tenderloin as
an area from 6th Street on the east to Broad Street on the west, from Vine Street on the south to Cattle Hill Street on the north.
A single block in the Tenderloin might have contained 20 brothels. These ranged from elegant and expensive resorts or parlor houses where young ladies sang and played the piano in addition to their other talents to cheap dives called loafer cribs. With so much competition, brothel owners relied on messenger boys to distribute advertisements to male travelers at nearby hotels and railroad stations.
Are you interested in a conversation with a woman? Are you interested in eating good food? We have the finest music available to you after hours, right? Because the resort or the parlor house that emerges in the late 19th, early 20th century are indeed places that have all those amenities.
One of the frankest and most infamous handbooks was the 1849 Guide to the Stranger, or Pocket Companion for the Fancy, containing a list of the gay houses and ladies of pleasure in the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. The anonymous author raided nearly 50 Philadelphia brothels. One of the four-star houses was Miss Josephine Summers at Wood and 11th Streets in the Tenderloin.
This is indeed a temple of Venus, and we do most sincerely assure our readers that Miss Josephine is an accomplished lady. You can spend an evening here with great pleasure. The young ladies are all beautiful, accomplished, and bewitching. Go one, go all, and you will be pleased.
At the other end of the spectrum was Sal Boyer, known as Dutch Sal, keeper of a dangerous panel house, where sliding walls enabled her to steal customers' valuables while they were otherwise engaged.
This is the lowest house in the city, a perfect loafer hole. No gentleman ever visits this Sodom. It is worse than hell itself.
By the dawn of the 20th century, Philadelphia boasted an estimated 5,000 prostitutes, more than any other American city. Its powerful crime syndicate protected the industry with generous payoffs to police and politicians. And young women flocked to the life, attracted by what John Alvidi calls its unparalleled earning potential.
A woman who was a streetwalker in Philadelphia in the late 19th century could easily make in a day more than $3. A streetwalker at the highest level would make $3 a trip.
At the highest level, a successful parlor house prostitute might have made $300 to $400 a week. At a time when weekly wages were less than $20 for a skilled factory worker and $10 for a shop girl. Of course, the average prostitute's career was only about 5 years. Clarissa Dillon points out that violence, disease, and addiction have been integral parts of a prostitute's life throughout history and around the world.
Being a whore was not fun. There was a quote in one of Boswell's journals about a whore he took in St. James Park, and his comment was, "She was lean and dank, and her breath smelled of spirits. I never asked her name." And that is the most dehumanizing, awful statement.
After World War II, the Tenderloin declined, and brothels moved south once again, closer to the historic center of prostitution in Philadelphia. One of the houses raided last month stood on South 6th Street near Wharton, an area where, even today, massage parlors and gentlemen's salons exist. That's just a few blocks away from the site of the China Factory, the brothel destroyed when righteous citizens took the law into their own hands 2 centuries ago.
WRTI's Tom Keels with the latest installment in our multi-part Wicked Philadelphia series. It explores forgotten scandals in the city's history, and a companion book is now published by the History Press. A new competition for young classical musicians is about to be launched. The Young Classical Music Idol competition is the brainchild of Nellie Berman, who runs her own music school on the Main Line. Idol aims to drum up friendly competition amongst aspiring teen and preteen musicians from around the region and beyond. When Nellie Berman started her school in 1983, she was the sole instructor for 7 students. Since then, it has blossomed into an institution with more than 400 students and a faculty of over 40, drawn from conservatories across the US and Europe. No stranger to playing at a young age, Berman herself was enrolled in a conservatory in her native Russia at age 10. When she arrived in the U.S. in 1976, she hoped to find a future which would allow her to share her love of music with others, but found that classical music was, by comparison with her homeland, underappreciated and undertaught. Berman says the idea for this new competition came from her own pedagogical philosophy and her almost 50 years as a music educator.
When I came to this country, I was quite surprised what a low priority classical music is for many families. And in the same time, we see quite a lot of people, especially in old age, not young age. If you look at the audience of Philadelphia Orchestra, it's old age. And young people have sports in their life. This is their major thing that they're doing. Sport, computers, games, not reading so much, not music so much. And this competition is result of many years of me trying to teach classical music on a little bit higher level. For this, we started non-for-profit institution. We give scholarships to around 30 students every year.
What's different about the way you teach? You say teach classical music on a higher level. You're talking about the amount of time you spend teaching them, because by comparison with where you're from, Russia, typically kids have 2-hour lessons, longer even, and here it's what, 40 minutes or an hour?
No, it's 30 minutes or 45, the most, usually, and once a week. We teach 2 times a week, and not everybody does this in my school, but I have a little girl who started with me at age 5, and now she's 7, and she plays serious music by Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin. I spend with her 2 hours sitting.
You've spent the last 25, 30 years teaching classical music on this sort of more intense level. Where did the idea for the competition come from?
Each Saturday, for the past, I would say, 4 or 5 years, we have a classical performance class, we call this. Kids can come and perform. They don't have to be ready. They are encouraged then to memorize, but they can come and play. And the way how it goes, that they criticize themselves. They say, technically it's very good, musically it should be improved, right hand should be louder, left hand should be softer.
And this is the kids talking to each other?
Kids talking to each other. And it's incredibly charming and very helpful to them to know that they can bring their own opinion. I only navigate them. I don't bring my own opinions into this. In some way, it's competition. And I see results of this, that more and more people want to come to these performing classes. And competition is a big part of classical music as a rule. But usually the competitions are on a very high level, on the level of universities, grown-up kids. My idea is that the way how this competition set up, that everybody will enjoy this.
Let's talk about the categories that are involved in this. Is it divided by instrument, by age, or both? How have you divided it?
By age. It's 4 categories, and they compete in between categories until they come to the finals. At the finals, they compete against each other.
So you could have, theoretically, a 7-year-old in the final competing against a 15-year-old.
Yes.
Competition is a very important part of the musician's life as they go forward in their career, because clearly, not just about winning competitions, they have to win auditions.
All right.
Do you feel this is going to be a good preparation for those who might, perhaps, going forward, want to pursue a professional career?
I think that it could encourage them to pursue professional career. Music, real competition has to bring a little bit humility, a little bit that I don't have to consider myself the best. And I do this not for competing. I do this for loving, for love towards music. And what is great, what I see in my school, that I see that kids practicing much more.
Right. It gives them a focus.
The goal. It's goal-oriented.
It's a goal. Right.
And this is always good. It teaches them they want something. They work for this. The main goal is to make it to believe that he or she is good and can do this.
Nellie Berman, creator of the Young Classical Music Idol Competition and Festival. The first auditions for the competition take place on March 21st at the Nellie Berman School of Music at 461 West Lancaster Avenue in Haverford. More information at nbsmusic.com. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. orchestrated by Tim Ribchester and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.